Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is Ask a Vegan. It's the 2nd of September 2012. Can you believe it's September already? Time marches on, doesn't it? And yet, some say that time stands still. Some say that there is no time. But right now, for me, it's Sunday, September 2nd, 2012. And I don't know, there seems to be some time going on. I wanted to talk about some things in the news. It's always fun to read the news and see what's going on and then kind of put our own spin on it. Everybody's spinning. Everybody's got their own spin. So in the Arteriosclerosis Journal, don't you love that there are so many medical journals today that are so specialized? Okay, we don't just have a health and wellness or a journal of the American Medical Professionals or something. We have an arteriosclerosis journal, a journal just related to that luscious plaque coating our arteries and giving us heart disease. Okay, well, something fun came out in the news. It was published on the 10th of August, 2012, less than a month ago. And it was about egg yolk consumption. Now, I know that a lot of people have mixed feelings about eggs. Now, let's just take a moment before I get into the content of this article, because I think it's always important to bring up what goes on with animals and how we get food from them. And eggs, of course, probably 99% of the eggs that are produced in this country are from factory farms, from hens that are crammed into cages or into very tiny spaces. And they don't get to move their wings. They live in very filthy conditions. They're diseased. They have sores. It's a very, very sad situation. And they're kept in very abnormal conditions in order to maximize the number of eggs that they lay. So those people that are choosing to eat eggs, if you're going to choose eggs, they should certainly be from a happy hen that you know and not from one of these factory farms. And that can be a little challenging since most of the eggs today come from factory farms. How can you make sure you're going to know the egg that you're going to eat and know the hen that it came from? And that's only if you take care of the hens yourself and raise them, or if you know someone else that does. But all that being said, do you really want to eat eggs? Personally, I don't think they're a really healthy food. And I know there's been a lot of mixed information over the years about eggs. But back to the Arteriosclerosis Journal, they came up with a really interesting comparison. And they're talking about egg yolk years, and they're comparing it to pack years. When we used to talk about the dangers of smoking, pack years of smoking and egg yolk years, they looked at 1,262 patients who averaged about, the mean age was 61 and a half years, 47% were women. And their findings suggest that regular consumption of egg yolk should be avoided, I repeat, avoided by persons at risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, who's at risk for cardiovascular disease? Well, I mean, that depends on who you talk to, but we could all be at risk of cardiovascular disease if we ate things that were continually coating our arteries. Okay, anyway, so egg yolk is not recommended for people with risk of cardiovascular disease, and they recommend more study. But what's interesting is it says that the effect size of egg yolks appears to be approximately two-thirds that of smoking. And so here it is. If you think that you don't want to smoke because it's not healthy, well, egg yolk consumption is pretty damaging and right up there with the dangers of smoking. So that's it for eggs. And the thing is, if you're into cooking and preparing food, we can really make everything that we need and bake anything that we want without eggs. I'm personally quite passionate these days about gluten-free baking because this is something that I think is particularly challenging. People that can't consume gluten, they go out and buy gluten-free products or try their hand at gluten-free baking. And all of these products have eggs in them because eggs make it easier to bind flours like gluten does, gluten in wheat and gluten in rye and barley. But you can get very similar, delicious products without the use of eggs. And it's heartbreaking to me sometimes for people who really want to avoid foods that are related to cruelty. And eggs are certainly related to cruel handling of animals. But some feel like they don't have necessarily a choice because of the particular illness that they have or allergy. And that's why I keep putting up more gluten-free vegan recipes on the responsibleeatingandliving.com website. So that's the thing about eggs. I like to talk about eggs because I know more and more people are putting chickens in their backyards. And I hope that those who are doing that are really getting to know their chickens and are enjoying them as companions rather than little machines that are making eggs. But eggs really are not healthy. And the recommendation from this report is maybe 4 eggs a week at most. That's not a lot, especially if you're going out on the weekend and you're having brunch and you get a 3-egg omelet and then you're having eggs during the rest of the week. That's where tofu comes in. Tofu is a genius egg replacer, especially when it comes to breakfast food. I just had a great scrambled tofu dish. We went out and met some relatives in Manhattan earlier today, and we went to Spring Street Natural. I don't know if you're familiar with that, those of you who are New York City people, but I've stepped in there over the years. Gosh, it's been a long time now. What I really like about it, it's a big space. Actually, there's 2 now, and I haven't been to the new one, but the one down in Soho, it's a big space, and it's really quite cozy. And you can fit a lot of people in there, and they have food for everyone. So they it's not a vegetarian restaurant, but it's very vegetarian friendly. It's kind of macrobiotic based, and really lovely food there. The thing that I really love is they have a pot of kukicha tea, and you can grab a cup and keep refilling it as much as you want with this kukicha tea. They have other teas for sale there, but the kukicha is free and bottomless and lovely. Have you ever had kukicha tea? It's made from the twigs or the stems of tea leaf plants rather than using the leaves, and it has a lovely, lovely flavor. Love kukicha. So they had a tofu scramble on the menu, which I had. It was excellent, with shiitake mushrooms and onions, served with a little salad, brown rice, tahini dressing. What more could you ask for? No need for eggs. All right, what else is in the news? Well, our government is certainly in the news a lot today, and I'm not going to talk about politics. I'm not going to talk about politics. There's too much going on today about politics. And basically, I just wish we had government leaders that would support what was best for the people in this country so that we could all pursue our dreams. We could all have roofs over our heads that we could all eat healthfully. We could all have access to health care when we need it. And excellent education. That's all I ask for. But the Food and Drug Administration, is slacking off a little bit, and I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm sure they have a lot of good reasons. But signed into law by President Obama on January 4th, 2011, that was like a year and a half ago, was the Food Safety and Modernization Act. The acronym is FSMA, F-S-M-A, and it contained critical food safety regulations. And the FDA has not implemented this law as of yet. And so the Center for Food Safety just a couple of days ago filed suit in federal court against the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Office of Management and Budget, OMB. You've heard of OMG. This is OMB, OMGA. Office of Management and Budget, for their failure to implement several critical food safety regulations as required by the FSMA, Food Safety and Modernization Act. And what's going on? Are they dragging their feet? I don't know. But now it's really hard to know how we get things done because we make laws. People don't follow laws. People don't implement laws. There are so many laws today that are ignored. I know the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't follow through with things that different businesses are supposed to be doing. I know there's all kinds of regulations that factory farms don't follow, and they end up polluting neighborhoods, and they are fined, and they never pay the fines, and things never get followed up. So I'm not exactly sure how far the Center for Food Safety will get with their suit filed in federal court. But the thing is, we do need more regulation, and some people may feel that we need less government and less regulation. But actually, there are some really good things that are going on in this country as compared to other countries. And I'm not one to say that it's better here than anywhere else. We certainly have a lot of wonderful opportunities here. But because of some of the regulations we have, we have some advantages here over other places. And we can do a lot better when it comes to food safety, but there are a lot of things in place that really do make a difference. But we need to do a lot more. And there's a lot of problems with food-borne diseases in this country. It's estimated from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, that an estimated 1 in 6 Americans, 48 million people, become ill from foodborne diseases every year. Approximately 128,000 are hospitalized and 3,000 die based on exposure to pathogens present in the food supply. And so this Food Safety and Modernization Act, FSMA, targets a range of necessary preventative measures that would immediately and aggressively work to reduce the impact of many illnesses caused by U.S. foodborne hazards. And that's important to me. What's very frustrating is I know that most of these foodborne illnesses originate from the intensification and the concentration of animals, raising animals for food. So we cram them into factory farms, we cram them into filthy spaces so that we can grow a lot of them and maximize cost without any regard to their feelings, their pain and suffering, or the health or the quality or the cleanliness of the environment. And so we need regulation there. And I know that what I was just saying about foodborne illnesses originating from these animal foods or these animals that become food, the problem is it affects the food that I eat. It affects the plant foods because the fertilizers become contaminated, because the water becomes contaminated, because the facilities that handle meats and different kinds of things, all of it gets, one thing touches another in shipping and in packaging, and these pathogens just get all over the place. A fun place to visit online, should you be surfing, is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC website, cdc.gov. And a particular page that I'm looking at, just for fun, is the cdc.gov/outbreaks/index.html. I suppose you could Google CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, outbreaks. They give you a current outbreak list, and you can see what's going on in the United States. And they also have some things that might affect international travelers. But just looking on what's going on today, we have the mango infection, a multi-state outbreak of Salmonella Brandurup infections associated with mangoes. Only 105 people have been affected with the outbreak strain since July 1st, 2012. And they're in a number of different states: California, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Louisiana, Maine, Montana, Nebraska, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Texas, Washington, Wisconsin, Idaho. And this is just one example. This isn't a lot of people. I feel bad for each one of those individuals who's been affected, and have been 25 of whom have been hospitalized. They're from... Did they tell you where these mangoes are from? Daniela brand mangoes. And I don't know. But it's just heartbreaking to me that this happens. From plant foods, innocent plant foods, there's a multi-state outbreak of Salmonella typhimurium. Okay, that's a mouthful. Linked to cantaloupe. Since, let's see, does it say since when? This is an August 30th update, and it's been in lots of states. 2,204 people are affected, and they're from Chamberlain Farms in Indiana. That's the source of the outbreak. And so you can go to cdc.gov and find out more about what's going on. There's a live poultry outbreak that has affected only 37 people. But the thing is, these things are going on all the time. And if we had some more regulations in place, that would be helpful. Of course, my dream, you know what my dream is. My dream is we eliminate factory farming. We eliminate the cruelty to animals being raised for food. And magically, lots of problems go away. So we just put that out there. And it's happening slowly. More people are getting interested in healthy food. But you know what's interesting to me? Now, maybe you are already a vegan. Maybe you've been doing it for a long time. Maybe you're just transitioning. What I find is that many people who are vegan, who have been on this healthy path and think they're eating healthy, actually aren't doing the best that they can. They may know it or have forgotten what they should be doing, but I just wanted to go over a few important points because I think we're learning in leaps and bounds about nutrition. There are so many things that we never knew before, and a lot of information is coming in. It's an opportunity to get confused. It's an opportunity to misinterpret things. Here's my take on the whole thing. So 100 years ago, we really knew very little, and the public knew very little. Now the public knows more, but not really much more. The public now has a vocabulary of words. The public knows protein, carbohydrate, and fat. They may not know what they are, but they know those words. We have words like salt, sugar, and fructose, and sucrose, and glucose. We have fats, saturated fat, unsaturated fats, hydrogenated oils, omega-3 fatty acids, omega-6 fatty acids, a few acronyms, DHA, EPA. And these things are starting to creep their way into American vocabulary without people really understanding what they are. And I don't even think most nutritionists are really on top of the latest information. So there are people that are following a healthy vegan diet or what they think is a healthy vegan diet and then just kind of forget. And then they may get some health problems. It's kind of, and it can be embarrassing for people that are promoting health and wellness to have an illness, because all of a sudden it's very easy for everyone else to say, oh, I thought you were on such a healthy diet. And it's a problem, especially for those of us who are vegan primarily for ethical reasons. We don't see the need or the point to consume animals because it causes pain and suffering, because these animals, every animal life, every sentient being has the right to live its life as it chooses, free and not exploited. And my perspective has always been to get people to come over to my side and agree with me and understand this point of not causing pain and suffering and not participating in the exploitation of sentient beings. The way that I want to do it is to look as good as I can, as healthy as I can, as young as I can, as fit as I can, to show that the diet that I choose to be on is the best diet. And if people like me get sick, well, then all of a sudden the argument kind of falls apart. And, you know, it did happen to me. I got cancer 6 years ago. I have an understanding of why it happened, and I absolutely believe that I am here because I made specific changes in my diet and got on an even healthier diet. But a lot of people think they're eating healthfully and really could be doing better. So what do I mean by that? Certainly the Coke, French fry, potato chip thing is not the healthiest thing. But I am a believer. I come from the green camp. I don't come from the grain camp. There are a lot of people that base their meals on whole grains. I'm not a fan of whole grains. I find that when I get a lot of calories from whole grains, I put on weight. I find it's easier to keep the weight that I like. Not that I've ever had a weight problem, but, you know, things can move around 10 pounds, plus or minus 5 pounds, and the weight that I like, where I think I look the best, is when I'm limiting my grains. Doesn't mean I'm hungry. I'm extremely satisfied with the food that I eat because I'm eating high water content, high fiber foods. Lots of salads, lots of greens, and lots of non-starchy vegetables. You can eat a lot of these foods and feel full. And I think we've kind of gone through some sort of evolution when it comes to nutrition, because we're learning so much so quickly, and things that seemed healthy we're realizing are not the healthiest, right? So I remember when I was in college in the late 70s, and we were talking about whole grain bread, and it had this kind of earthy, hippie, nutritious feeling to it because we had grown up on Wonder Bread, a very unhealthy bread. But as I've learned, the way the white bread, manufactured white bread, came into play was because people thought it was healthier because it was prepared in a facility that was clean as compared to the little bakeries of the early 1900s that weren't regulated and were not too clean and had a lot of immigrants that were making the bread. People imagined that this bread was dirty. Now, I don't know how many actual accounts of foodborne illnesses there were back then, but the point is that our perception of healthy food has changed as our access to different foods becomes available and as our knowledge changes. I don't think that the diet that we're discovering to be the healthiest diet is a diet that anyone has ever really lived on before. I know that John Robbins wrote a book a while ago called Healthy at 100, and he talked about four different groups of people, all of them on the way out, all of them not living much longer. these groups all lived long lives to at least about 100, and he tried to figure out what they were all doing in common. And what they were doing was they lived in somewhat mountainous regions. They walked a lot and they lifted a lot of weight. So they had a good amount of exercise and they ate a primarily plant-based diet, a little bit of fish, a little bit of dairy. But I don't think that there's really any population, at least in the last 1,000 years or so, that have been living on a Dr. Furman recommended diet, the Eat to Live diet, the diet that is what I'm talking about, a lot of green, a lot of leafy greens, non-starchy vegetables, some fruits, limited grains, unlimited beans. This is an interesting diet, and we're in a learning process. And so I know that some of my peers think that brown rice and quinoa are good basis for meals, and they're fine. Brown rice and quinoa are fine. But personally, I don't like to eat a lot of them, and I don't eat a lot of grains. I don't even eat them every day, aside from a bowl of oatmeal in the morning. I have to admit that I do have half a cup of oatmeal most mornings. But I'm not a big bread eater, and I'm not a big grain eater. So I want to remind everyone what I think is the healthiest food, and that is salads, steamed greens, greens any way you can get them in smoothies and in raw salads, stir fries, soups, of course, putting the salt and oil aside because we don't need those things. We don't need oil and salt to make food taste good. We don't need oil and salt. They're not healthy. I had a conversation with Brian Clement on Wednesday on May It's All About Food show. I don't know if you caught it, but I found it really interesting to talk with him because I think he, along with many others, has been on a path of learning more and more about food, especially working with people who are critically ill and seeing how they respond to certain diets. And we talked about fruit. And I want to say that organic fruit, fruit that hasn't been exposed to pesticides and herbicides, fruit the way nature intended it to be, can be a healthy food. I know that there are some people who are fruitarians that live only on fruit. There are some people that think the base of our diet should be fruit. I'm not in agreement with that. And, you know, if you feel differently about it, I'd love to hear from you. But we have plenty of fruit around here, but it's not, I might have one or two pieces of fruit a day, maybe three, and that's it. The majority of fruit that I consume are berries. I get frozen berries and I use them in smoothies. I certainly eat bananas. It's summertime now, so we have a little more variety of fruit like plums and nectarines. apples and oranges. They're all really, really wonderful and great when you have a craving for something sweet. Fruit will really take care of that craving. But for people that have cancer, I know that when I was going through my treatment, I only consumed berries and I did not have any of the sweet fruits. I know there was a time when I was on an all-raw diet and I would do the mono meal sometimes and I would just get watermelon and I would eat the whole watermelon, or I would get a bunch of mangoes and eat those mangoes, a papaya. Oh, and I was in heaven. I loved eating those foods. But now, you know, I wonder if it didn't contribute to future problems, because there really is a lot of sugar in those foods. And to get calories from fruit, we're not really getting all of those super duper phytochemicals that we get from the green foods or the beans. So I would watch it with the fruit. I wouldn't be afraid of it. Certainly whole fruit is better than fruit juice. But I'm not a proponent of an all-fruit diet or a primarily fruit diet. I go to the greens. That's my story. But again, you could send me your comments, your thoughts at info@realmeals.org. I really love to hear from you. I'm always open to learning new things. Let's move on. Can we talk about cheese for a moment? Okay, how many times have you heard, or how many times have you said it? Oh my God, I can't live without cheese. When we talk about how dairy is not a healthy food, one of the first responses is, oh my God, I can't live without cheese. I love cheese, 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 cheese. And we have a bunch of great recipes for nut and seed cheeses. You can make cheeses from cashews, almonds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds. What defines a cheese, actually? I didn't look that definition up. But when people say to me, does it taste like cheese? I find that to be a very interesting question. So what does cheese taste like to you? I think about the wide range of cheeses made from animal milk. Let's start with back in the days when I did eat cheese, which was a very long time ago, the ones that I would turn my nose up to, Velveeta, American cheese, these don't really have much flavor. They're just fat and salt. And similarly, there's cheeses like ricotta cheese, cottage cheese, farmer cheese, cream cheese. These all are relatively soft and have a light flavor to them. And then you get into the harder cheeses. There's Swiss cheese and Gruyere cheese. They're still kind of soft, but they're more firm than the ones I just previously mentioned. Cheddar cheese. And there's a whole range of cheeses that you can buy that I don't even know the names for. And each one of them have a very unique flavor. So what does cheese taste like? There are mild cheeses. There are very smelly cheeses. There are stinky, smelly, sour, salty. They all have many, many different flavors. And I say that because nut cheeses and seed cheeses have their own flavors. It's just opening up to new flavors. And how exciting is that? I think that when people make the transition and eliminate dairy, the nut and seed cheeses really are a wonderful replacement. They have their own unique flavors, that's sure. But they're fat and they're salt, and they fulfill that fat and salt need. And they come with all these wonderful nutrients that you don't get in animal cheeses. And you certainly don't get cholesterol. So just think about it sometime. When you think you're missing cheese, or you want to know what these vegan cheeses taste like, first describe what animal cheese tastes like, and then maybe we can have a conversation. I got a response from last week's show, and I wanted to talk a little bit about it because it was about my use of words, talking about animal rights and women's rights. And I'm actually rereading a book right now by Tom Regan called Empty Cages. And I think semantics are a very interesting thing. And we all can't be careful enough, because we can definitely take for granted things that we hear and then say things without realizing what they mean. For example, you know, I have my own personal stuff. I consider myself a feminist, and I've bristled for decades now with the abbreviation for a married woman, Mrs. MRS, period. I've for 30 years now been using MS, period, and I noticed that professional women tend to use MS, period, but then many married women still use the MRS, period, and it irks me. It irks me because there's just MR, period, for men and not for women, and when people use it, I want to correct them, but I often don't, just because it's not the right venue or it's not the right time to do that. But people really don't realize very often when they choose their words what impact they're having. And so I appreciated hearing the comment about using the word rights. I was talking about women getting the right to vote, and the point was that women always had the right to vote. We just needed to convince everyone else around us that we had that right in order so that women voting would be legalized. And the same thing with animals. Animals have rights. The problem is we don't acknowledge them. And that's one of the things that I want to do here on the Ask a Vegan Show, is help people see that we can be doing, each one of us, every day, with every meal, with every purchase, we can each be making a difference and acknowledging all life on Earth, all sentient beings, and making a positive difference for them. So thank you for that comment. I was talking before about gluten-free baking. I usually like to talk about a recipe or some cooking tips as the last thing I talk about on the Ask a Vegan Show. It's probably my favorite thing to do, preparing food. I'm not sure if you've ever baked bread. If you make a yeasted wheat bread, I know that people have said it's complicated. I don't think it's that complicated, and certainly there are machines that you can use, but it does take time. And the time mostly doesn't require you to be present. So what you do is you take warm water, you might add a little sweetener and some yeast. Certainly activated yeast is very accessible in stores today. If you get really sophisticated, you can grow your own starter, which I have done and is really very much fun. There are a variety of different starters that you can make from wheat flour or potatoes. All of them give a different flavor to the bread. And then you use that and you mix it in with some fresh wheat flour, white flour, whole wheat flour, other whole grain flours. But usually wheat is the basis, although you can be adding in rye and oats and corn and whatever you want to make a different kind of bread. And then you put it all together and you make a smooth dough, something where when you're kneading it with your fingers, your hands come out clean. So if it's sticky, you add a little more flour until you have a nice smooth dough. If it's very, very dry and crumbly, you add back in a little bit more water. And ultimately, you want to get this nice, elastic, smooth dough and your hands come clean. You mold it into a nice little ball. You cover it with a towel. You leave it in a dry, warm place for about an hour. It doubles in size. And then you take the towel off. You punch it down. You can let it rise again for another hour. And then you can put it in your bread pans, or you could mold it into a loaf shape. I like to make baguettes. And then you can bake it. And there you have this great bread. It smells up the whole house. Everything's great. And it's really not that difficult. Okay, so now let's add to the challenge and not use wheat and make it gluten-free. And this is where it gets sticky, pun intended, because it is a very sticky business. But I've been doing it for a while, and I've kind of figured out some of the tricks, and I just wanted to share them with you. I recently made a braided gluten-free bread, and it was really good, and what I was happy about was I was able to braid it. So here's the thing. When people make gluten-free breads today, most of the time they'll use either an all-purpose gluten-free flour that you can buy in the store. Bob's Red Mill is one of them, and it's a combination of garbanzo bean flour, fava bean flour, sorghum flour, a little tapioca starch, and I think that's it. Other combinations may come with a few other things like rice flour, but there's no wheat, there's no gluten. And you can do the bread process the same way, but you really need to add a lot of water to this mixture. So you don't make a dough, you make a batter. And if you're just putting it in a loaf pan, well, that's fine because you can pour it into the loaf pan, let it rise, and then bake it. But if you want to mold a bread, which is something that I really like to do, I like to make braided breads and shapes, this is where it gets challenging. So I came up with a mixture where I created a very, very, very wet sticky dough. So it wasn't entirely liquid, but I added enough water in it so that the bread wouldn't be too dense. It would have a lightness to it. And then I thoroughly coated my surface and my hands with the flour that I was using. I was using all-purpose gluten-free flour, but you can use garbanzo flour or whatever you're using. Thoroughly coat everything with a lot of flour, because if you don't, this dough is so sticky, you can't manipulate it at all. And when you've got everything coated with a light coat of flour, then you can braid it. You can make three long rolls of flour about an inch or two wide, and then braid them together and make a lovely, lovely braided bread. It's it could get a little messy with the flour everywhere, but you know, you can be careful and just confine it to a certain area. I've made small rolls this way, little baguettes, and it's really quite enjoyable and gluten-free. So for people that can't eat gluten, or people that want to limit their gluten, you can still have your bread and eat it too. Again, I want to underline that these are they're not quite like cake treats, but these aren't foods that I eat all that regularly because they are starchy, and it's just a few times a week when I have a need for a bread, I want to make a sandwich or I want to have some toast. This is really a great recipe. Again, you can use the other gluten-free yeasted bread recipes at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Some of them are the easier liquidy batter that you just pour into a mold. You don't even have to get involved with all the flour and coating on your hands. I just thought, if you want a braided bread, this is the way to do it. And there you go. Well, thank you for listening. This has been another Ask a Vegan show. Please send me an email at info@realmeals.org. Love to hear from you. And, you know, you can like this show, or over at iTunes at the Ask a Vegan show, you can make a positive comment down there. We'd love to have that. Like us on Facebook at Responsible Eating and Living. And other than that, happy plant eating, right? And be well. Have a great week.
REAL.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
REAL.
Real's good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do
when it comes to good health.
We need facts that are true to choose what to eat and save the planet too. As responsible eating and living.
You'll find the real tools for you.
Real.